Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz here live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet. What are you waiting for? Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And Clay texts in a relevant question after last night. Hey, guys, is there anyone in the organization you can credit for finding Joshua? Well, it's funny you should ask about that, Clay. And I know we've mentioned this on the show before, but, you know, worth getting into a little bit here, coming off of Dakota Joshua's big night. Now, of course, you know, every signing, group front office effort.
There's so much, and this one especially. So there was familiarity because the Canucks and the Blues shared an American League affiliate in Joshua's first professional season, I think?
No, it was his second. He's played AHL games in 1920, and then it was 2020-21 that he played.
Okay, so his second professional season.
Yeah.
They shared an American League affiliate. So there was some familiarity throughout the organization, but specifically current assistant general manager and former Utica Comets general manager, and not because he is no longer in that job, but because the Canucks relocated their American League.
Still the AHL GM.
Ryan Johnson. But, excuse me, but Alvin played a big role directly in that one as well.
Do you need some water?
I'm not dignifying that with a response. And honestly, the story of this club cannot be told without acknowledging the absolute heater that this entire management group and pro scouting staff has been on in terms of sort of mining valuable glue guys.
Yes, I agree with that. And I want to get into the whole list and the whole process. But Joshua stands out because I feel like there's been the most development. So it kind of encapsulates, it's not just the scouting and the ability to get the deal done at, you know, terms you want, but you win the bidding against other teams. It's then the development and the coaching process.
Right.
Like, Joshua is the guy who kind of encapsulates all of that.
And the opportunity.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of different stuff to get into, but one thing that should be acknowledged right off the bat, because again, there's a million people who deserve credit for this. It's not just it's not as simple as the Ryan Johnson thing, although that's the fun, that's like the cleanest story to tell. And it's true. Like, there's an element of it that's true. But don't ignore the impact that assistant general manager Cammy Granato has had on just improving process.
Mm.
You think about what the pro scouting was like under the sort of Jim Benning era, right? And, you know, the list of misses, Beagle, Roussel, Oliver Ekman-Larsson. I mean, we could do a whole segment on
that. Yeah, we could be here a long time.
And we have. But here's the fundamental thing. Like, Vancouver's director of pro scouting, Brett Henning, has been with the organization for a long time and served in the same capacity under Benning, right? Neil Komodowski, Lou Crawford. I mean, go down the list. Like, Vancouver hasn't actually changed much in terms of the people they have evaluating players on the pro side. What they've changed is the way they share information, what they're instructed to do. And in particular, my understanding is Granato's impact has been on how that information is like stored, shared, and utilized, standardized. And by the way, both across pro and amateur scouting departments. So I think that's something too that we have to note. Because, you know, it wasn't just Joshua either, right? Like, Joshua was signed the same summer as Kuzmenko.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of the league was after Kuzmenko, but that doesn't change the fact that the Canucks nailed, you know, like a free play on Kuzmenko. Whatever you want to say about the $5.5 million extension, or how Kuzmenko performed this season, or the fact that the club ultimately viewed that deal as one they had to get out of before it became a liability, which frankly is a big part of the Lindholm trade, or the logic of the Lindholm trade internally. It's not like they paid an acquisition cost. It's not like the fact that Kuzmenko didn't hit in year two, you know, came with significant like draft pick capital that they'd expended in order to get him. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people, this whole organization deserves a ton of credit for it. And then you get to, you know, the development side and the opportunity side of this. And this is one thing to watch here, because we've talked about all of Vancouver's expiring contracts a lot. We'll continue to do so, I'm sure, as this playoff run plays out, and especially whenever it ends. Vancouver's not going to be able to keep all of the players
of
who've excelled for them. And on some level, that amps up the stakes of this playoff run, because, you know, as much as this organization has shown an ability to find and identify undervalued players, your Pew Suter class guys, over and again, not just last offseason, but I'd argue the offseason prior, even though that was, you know, less of a smash success. It's just hard to have as much surplus value on your roster at any given time as Vancouver has had this season, given all of the singles that they've hit.
Yeah, it's hard to go, like, you know, in baseball terms, if you want to use the singles analogy, it's hard to go like 4-for-4 or 4-for-5 every game. Well, you know what I mean? Even the best hitters don't.
Well, in baseball, I honestly think baseball's a good, like, at baseball, if you only fail 70% of the time, you're one of the best to ever do it. If you only fail 70% of the time.
If you isolate that to the UFA market, like if 30%, seriously, you look at like NHL history, if like 30% of your UFA signings are great,
yeah,
that's, well, wow, that's a good ratio.
You're going to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a really good time watching your team play.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that still assumes the fail rate, right? Like it's just hard to get on that sort of heater and sustain that sort of heater year over year over year. But one thing that is going to be in Vancouver's favor is that if you're ex fourth line center, right, looking for a place to play, well, you see how Teddy Bluger performed. Mm. You see the opportunities that Bluger got. You see the defensive results that this team got. You say, hey, they're probably going to be a playoff team. They're going to be in a high visibility market with lots of media people telling my story. There's a lot of built-in advantages that the Canucks are able to offer on that player development side to players looking for like a one-year deal, a rebuild my value deal, something like that, right? So if you're a second pair defenseman that maybe is left out in the cold in the first wave of free agency, right? Or if you're left to sign a one-year deal, do you look at Cole's minutes and, mm-hmm. and what happened and whatever he signs his next deal for? Do you look at Zadorov and whether he built up his value playing in Vancouver? If you're a 25-year-old, 26-year-old Group 6 UFA, maybe with some like rare attributes the way Joshua has them, but you haven't necessarily seen a regular look in the NHL yet, is Vancouver a team that maybe can offer you an opportunity to establish yourself and go on a similar trajectory? Whether the club can keep Joshua or not is his story. Are the 2 years that he spent here something that's actually a arrow in Vancouver's quiver when they go out looking to restock the depth of their club this summer? And hopefully they can keep him, but in the event that they can't, is the value that they've gained there sort of intangible, and does it extend beyond Joshua and into other players?
You got to think it helps, 100%. Right? Not that it's the only thing, of course, that players are going to value or the players are going to think about. There's so many things that go into a UFA decision when a player's on the market like that. But I also just have to think, you know, even beyond being able to point at Joshua or Ian Cole or, you know, Teddy Bluger in general, the job that Rick Tocchet has done has to be a major selling point in that. And the two things are related, right? Like Rick Tocchet has helped those players. The coaching staff has helped those players have the seasons that they've had. And, you know, like even I throw Tyler Myers and look at the season that he's had in, right? And that was a guy who was under the microscope in so many different ways. I think he's had his best year as a Canucks defenseman playing in this system. But I think it's definitely in large part because of what Rick Tocchet has done and the way he's got this team to play. I don't see how it couldn't be a more attractive landing spot for free agents, right? When you have the ability to go with a coaching staff that's had this type of success recently this year, and you see what it's done for Dakota Joshua, amongst others, like, that's got to be appealing. Certainly for some players, not all. Again, not the only thing they're gonna consider. But I think, as you said, some of those guys kind of further down, you know, the non-marquee names, or, you know, guys who didn't get the deal they wanted right on July 1st are still around a little bit later. And now, he's not a UFA, but like, even throw Pugh Suter in there in terms of a guy getting play up the lineup, right, who signed here as an unrestricted free agent. So it's definitely going to be a weapon for them. The question is, how much of this UFA class can you kind of turn over and replace and get the same results, get that same efficiency, get that same kind of punching above your weight factor as you had with this year's UFA class? And somebody texts in, you know, big question is, will we be able to afford Dak? They're going to be able to afford him. It's just the question of, what does it force you to sacrifice elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I think that's the best way to looking at it. And then, does the price get so steep that
it becomes
the balance
unwise.
Becomes, you know, okay, yes, we could afford him, but we would just have to sacrifice so many other things that it doesn't make sense to do it. I think that's the way of looking at it. But at this point, man, as you said, like, he's capable. He looks capable of playing higher up the lineup. And as soon as you go from, hey, he's having a really nice year as a third liner, to, hey, this is a guy that we think can play an even bigger role for us, all of a sudden the numbers we're throwing around, you know, 3.75 times 4, seem a lot less daunting if you think that guy has upside even higher up the lineup than just on the third line.
Yeah. And I think he does. Like, I'm just convinced.
I think that's fair. And Nanaimo Stewie texted, and I believe Garland deserves some credit for Joshua's success as well. No doubt about it. And Garland had the crack a few weeks ago, right? That he's going to have to buy him dinner. Joshua's going to have to buy him dinner after he signs his next contract. But Joshua, like, yes, of course, you have to have, every player needs the right opportunity to become the best versions of themselves as a player. And I think Joshua's found that playing alongside Connor Garland. Wow, that was a wild one. Connor Garland. But Joshua,
he was
Connor
Garland.
Almost.
Now he's like core piece.
Seriously. You're talking about, like, hey, if you're a UFA, what's a selling point? I don't know, playing with Connor Garland. If Joshua's not here, I'd want to be getting those sick from, you know, below the goal line feeds into the slot, like, yeah. Joshua's getting.
Well, do you remember we used to talk about Connor Garland and, like, the chemistry that he'd struggled to find with various Canucks centermen? And mm-hmm. You know, I used to bring up, like, Martin Hanzel, like, you know, the idea of, like, the big lefty pass first centerman that I thought would be ideal for him to play with. Turns out it was a shoot first winger who's elite on the forecheck.
Mm-hmm.
An elite F1.
It does make me think, like, if there could have been something there with Bo Horvat and Connor Garland. But anyways, we don't need to go down that road right now. But just as you described that kind of skill set
with Dakota Joshua.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm picking up what you're putting down. I'm interested in that.
This one comes in my opinion, priorities to re-sign have to be: 1, Joshua; 2, Zadorov. Both bring unique skills with size that are hard to find. Suter, Bluger, etc. have been good, but very replaceable, and skills that are common in UFA land. Suter is under contract for one more year, so they won't have to think about replacing him, but Bluger, yes. And I know you've made a similar point as well, right? That Zadorov just has that ability to play on the edge that is relatively rare in today's game. I just think the number for Zadorov is going to scare me more than the number for Joshua. So I would still have Dakota Joshua as clearly the number one UFA that I want to re-sign.
The UFA. So we're not talking...
We're not talking RFAs.
Yeah.
I mean, we can throw Hronek in there if you want, because he's obviously, he's got to be the number one priority.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. Like, the thing is it's a really thin UFA market, just like kind of across the board. You know, Bluger's not easy to replace by any means. So, and man, he's played really well this year. Like, mm-hmm. he's been a really top end two-way contributor. You know, tied his career high in points. I don't know, like, as good as Lindholm's been and as good as Lindholm was last night, I mean, I do think Bluger was doing the top nine job fine. You know, if you go into next season and you've got Bluger penciled in as sort of the front runner to be your third line center, and you kind of have Pugh Suter who can also raise your floor there if you need it, and maybe you bring in one other guy to compete with that. Like, I like that. I don't think if you go into next season, Pettersson, Miller, Blueger for me would be pretty high. I think Zadorov would be pretty high,
and especially because
they're all good, man. This is the thing.
Yeah, and the Blueger
it's a good
one,
place to be.
Like, you're looking at him now, and he's the fourth line center, right? But you know, there's always a curveball that could be thrown. But I don't see Elias Lindholm being here past this year.
It's going to be very hard to keep.
So then that opens up a huge, huge hole at third line center, right? It's not, you're not losing your fourth line center. You're losing a guy who has been your third line center for most of the year in Teddy Blueger. And as you said, has done a pretty good job at it. So, and I also don't know, like, how much of a raise do you think Blueger has earned?
Oh, significant.
Like,
let me give you this. Okay. Here's the fundamentals underpinning this. There are headed toward pending unrestricted free agency. Seven UFAs, 25 points or higher. Blueger.
At center. Oh, man.
Blueger, Wennberg, Roslovic, Lindholm, Domi, Stevenson, Monahan. So of those seven, only one of them is like a yeoman's work, you know, stud center like Blueger, like a stud defensive center, right? The other, to get another guy who profiles similarly, Pierre-Édouard Bellemare, who's 39 years old and had 7 points. If you think Steven Lorenz from Florida can be a full-time center, but Florida doesn't. They play Kevin Stenlund in that lineup. So Kevin Stenlund, I guess. I'm at a loss.
Yeah.
I run out of names very, very quickly. Like, you know, Blueger's going to have a big market. Could we talk about like 2.5x4, the Kampf deal? For me, feels like a baseline, and I think upside to get more. Honestly, depending on his usage in the postseason here, I think there's upside to get more.
He's definitely going to be one of those players where every team that needs a third line center is going to be linked to Teddy Blueger. You know what I mean?
He's really well for himself.
Clear like third line center option on the UFA market now.
So I actually, like, quietly, I think he's really hard to replace.
Yeah. Now, he's making 1.9 this year, right? So let's say it was 4 years by 2.5. That's term, but that's not a massive increase just in terms of the AAV. So to me, like,
it's not massive, no.
That's a deal I'd be pretty comfortable with. Right? Because
four times 2.5?
The term makes me nervous, but as you said, like, in terms of the AAV, I think I'd be willing to go there because it's not that big a jump over what he's making right now.
Sure.
Right? So I think that makes it a little easier to swallow. You can kind of slot him in the same way that he was this year. Now, JFID texts in, any Abbey players ready to replace Blueger? No. Not to do what he does. Now, could Atu Ratu make the team? Yes, but you're not bringing in Atu Ratu and tasking him with the same role as Teddy Blueger, right? Mm-hmm. Like, could Ratu, let's say they re-signed Dakota Joshua. Could Ratu ride shotgun with Dakota Joshua and Connor Garland and have a really nice year? Yeah, he absolutely could, but he's not going to be one of your first choice penalty killers, which Teddy Blueger has, and he's done a good job at it, right? So you're losing all those other things. You're losing the ability to, you know, move him around the lineup, play him in tough matchup minutes. Maybe that's the route they have to go. Maybe that's the route they decide to go, but it's not a clean one-to-one replacement if that's what ends up happening.
Yeah. Yeah, and so let's look at, if we look at UFA defensemen, okay, over 6'3", 20 points or more.
Is it just Tyler Myers?
There's four.
Oh, wow.
Myers, Zadorov, Canucks have two of them. Brendan Dillon, interesting name.
Mm-hmm.
33 years old out in Winnipeg. Really good player. Would definitely like to come home at some point. I think there's a potential fit there. He'd be a great fit for the Canucks. And Brady Shea, who's going to be a $6 or $7 million player.
Yes.
That's it. And then you get into like your Pesci, who's also going to be a $6 or $7 million player. And then you're like DeHarnay, Josh Brown crew. So, yeah, these are not going to be easy or affordable pieces to replace.
These are tough decisions.
Really tough decisions.
And the reason we got, and we're not trying to get ahead of ourselves here, right? They just played game one of the playoffs. But, you know, the reason we went down this road is, one, talking about Dakota Joshua, but also, and I know you wrote about this at The Athletic, like really driving home that point about the stakes for this playoff run and how much, like, not that you can't be in a similar position next year. No one's saying that. No one's saying that it's going to be impossible. But it's just, as we've all seen, so many things have gone right for the Canucks this year. And this is the point I've been making about, you know, would a first round playoff exit be a disappointment? When you've had this many things go right, and when there are some foreseeable challenges on the horizon, you want to make this moment count, right? And Dakota Joshua kind of symbolizes that, but there's a lot more that goes into it beyond that. And hey, they did it in game one, right? They stepped up to the plate. They got some massive performances. They looked like they were really right into playoff mode, so it's great. But I think what you're emphasizing is this is a potentially huge deal for the franchise, given all the decisions they have to make come summer.
Well, for sure. I also think it's, you know, that Joshua's representative of a major reason why this team's taken the quantum leap forward that they have, right? Which is Cole, DeSmith, Susie, Zadorov, you know,
Lafferty,
like Joshua Lafferty. Yeah. Like all of these Pew Suter, Teddy Bluger, all of these glue guys that have come in. I mean, it's like an army of them. There's like 8 or 9 killing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, that's been baked into this team's identity. And I do think it's one that I think really hammers home that this is a moment in time. Right, for a team that eschewed a longer path to try and get here and pulled it off, right? And, you know, I'm not going to say like last dance or anything like that. But for this team as it's composed, right, this is a singular moment, a singular opportunity, which is why we've got to really enjoy a night like last night, right? And why I think there's stakes ahead, like as we begin this journey and as this journey began in such a special way in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of the game, in terms of that moment, right? I think it's worth being clear-eyed about sort of what's to come, not just in the offseason, but down the stretch and why it matters for this group.
No doubt about it. All right, we got one final segment coming up here. We're seeing some quotes come in from Rick Tocchet after Canucks practice. We'll see if we can get that audio in and turned around. Always a pleasure to hear from the Canucks head coach, especially now come playoff time. So we'll see if we can get that to you, and we'll continue to take your text. Look ahead to more playoff games tonight around the league. And then, of course, game two tomorrow night at Rogers Arena here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Miss any part of Halford and Brough in the Morning? Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and don't miss an episode.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, final segment of a special three-hour edition of Canucks Talk. And again, we will be on at 11 from 11 till 2 every day for as long as the Canucks are in the playoffs. And they started it off in style with a 4-2 win over Nashville in game one last night. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Again, Rick Tocchet just wrapping up chatting with the media, so we'll see if we get some commentary in from Rick Tocchet here before the end of the show. I did just want to read this. We'll move on in a second here from the conversation we were having in the last segment, but Larry and Van texted it in. Dak, Zadorov, and Myers are must signs. There you go. Tyler Myers has gone all the way to a must sign as a UFA, at least in the eyes of Larry in Vancouver. That's how you know things are different in Vancouver now. People are texting in. They must re-sign Tyler Myers.
He's played awesome.
He was great. He was really good last night, man. It looked awesome.
He's one of the 30 highest scoring right-handed defensemen. Mm-hmm. He's 6'7". He's been this team's most important penalty killer among their blue liners, in my opinion. Like him and Cole, right, have been there. As Cole and Myers have seen their shorthanded ice time spike, Vancouver's penalty killing has improved. And that's not a coincidence. So, I don't know. I mean, that's not exactly like a template for a player that you find.
No. Who's also like an awesome dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's also a noted great teammate and mm-hmm. classy individual. Yeah. Good point.
This text also comes in 650. Instead of worrying about stressful things like the cap, can we just spend the last segment pooping on Arizona and the Leafs? Need to go out on happy feels. I mean,
pooping.
Well, I cleaned it up a little bit for radio.
Poopa.
Poopa.
Sorry.
Look,
who are you pooping on?
The Coyotes, which we don't need. Look, they're done. They're gone. They're in Utah now. So we can give that a rest for at least now.
Yeah.
But the Leafs, the more things change, the more things stay the same.
That they couldn't break out to save their lives. Like, I don't know if Benoit, Edmondson, and Lyubushkin can coexist on the same blue line, especially when you have Brody as an option.
Yeah.
That to me feels wild. I still think they're going to win the series because I don't think they're very good, and I think every
the
year
Bruins.
We see...
Yeah. You don't think the Bruins are very good?
No, I don't think the Leafs are very good.
But that was a weird sentence formation then. You said you still think they're going to win this series because I don't think they're very good.
Yeah, correct.
Wait, what?
Sorry, have I not explained this to you? I've decided to do the following.
Oh, I see. I see. This is your, like, the illogical thing is going to happen.
Correct. I've decided that in making my playoff picks every year from now on, I'm going to randomly select one of the four sides of the bracket and pick the team that I think has done the most stupid stuff to advance to the conference final.
All right.
That's my new rule. I'm calling it the stupidity corollary. And I'm just assuming that on at least one side of the bracket, one team that's done a bunch of stuff that I think makes no sense whatsoever is going to make the conference final every year.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's why I'm
picking you picking the Leafs as like believing in the team. Because it's like, as you said, that blue line... Yikes.
Oh, I don't think anything they've done has made a lick of sense. I mean, when you look at what Vancouver was able to do with Susie and Pew Suter and how much the Leafs spent instead on, like, scoring forwards? That's what they thought they needed more of? Scoring? And like, one-dimensional scoring forwards who are kind of pests? That's what they thought they needed? Slow defenders who with size and... one-dimensional scoring forwards. Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Hey, they crushed it in that regard.
Yeah, it's just wild. Like, Kampf on a big money deal. Reeves on a big money deal. Part ways with Lafferty. Sign all these big defense. None of it made a lick of sense. Like, it was astonishing to me to watch. And so, yeah, I think they're going to the conference final.
There you go. All right. I was so confused there for a second. I was like, what are you talking about?
Excuse me. I guess I hadn't explained
it. No, you hadn't. You would explain. I think you explained picking them for that reason, but I hadn't quite put everything together there. That yeah. You were explicitly picking them because you don't think they're as good.
Well, especially because like Boston's so remarkable in their ability to just keep coming.
Yeah,
right. The Panthers, I thought, had one of the best off seasons in the league, given that they were going to be down both their number one and number two defensemen for the first 6 weeks of the season,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of took this scattershot approach to upgrading their blue line and filled out their depth. Like, the Stenlin find was excellent. That's you know, very much like a Canucks type move in terms of pulling a guy sort of off the scrap heap, and he's been impactful for them. Evan Rodriguez has fit in really well with them. Stolarz has been fantastic as Bobrovsky's backup. I just think, you know, the Panthers have done a ton of smart stuff. We know what the Lightning do, right? Like, we know the Lightning are counting cards, finding clever ways to keep improving. Darren Radish in particular has been a revelation for them. And so within that milieu, obviously the team that has done the least impressive team building stuff is going to advance.
All right, 650, 650 is the number. No, fair enough. Yeah. Just embrace the chaos at a certain point. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This one, can we give Ian Cole some love? He was a steady defensive presence all night, breaking up passes, blocking shots, and being in the right position all night. And I do think there was kind of a class of players last night for me, or a group of players anyways, who had really strong early parts of the season and then weren't necessarily bad down the stretch, but their production or their performance had dropped off. And then they were really good last night. I thought Filip Hronek played a fantastic game last night. I thought Brock Besser was really good last night. And I thought Ian Cole was really good as well last night. And we're going to focus on, you know, the size element and the physicality of Nikita Zadorov and Tyler Myers and Carson Soucy. But, you know, it's not as if Ian Cole is small out there. And we've all heard about, you know, the veteran presence and all that, his playoff experience. Just the fact that they have Ian Cole as kind of a luxury. Like, he's not one of their featured defensemen, but he is so smart. He is so cerebral as a guy who can soak up minutes at the bottom of your lineup. It's a big deal for the team. And I will just pass along this one from this quote from Rick Tocchet, courtesy of Brendan Batchelor, after practice today, who says, from Rick Tocchet, there's been times this year that I felt our team got a little antsy, and Ian Cole's demeanor after a game has helped us. We lost four in a row one time, and Kohler talked to the guys, and the next night we had a good night. And I think that...
So that was the Seattle game?
Sure.
That was they lost in Seattle and then came back and beat somebody. I can't remember who, but mm-hmm. they had a nice bounce back performance. I remember that sequence. Beyond the off-ice demeanor, the professionalism of Ian Cole, also the vocabulary.
He is such a good interview, man. Did you? You wouldn't have, because you would have been down in the room. But did like
Higgins?
The walk off. No, sorry, he did like the walk off interview
with Cater.
No. On the post game show,
okay.
They do like after they win, they do like an extended, you know, like 5 minute kind of walk off interview on the post game show, and every time it's Ian Cole, it's like, did we hire a new analyst or something? Like,
oh,
it's
he's
phenomenal!
He's
how good he is.
He's going to be such a good media guy if he wants to be. Well, he. He described the Philadelphia Flyers early in the season as playing playoff adjacent hockey. And I was like, oh, man, I'm going to have to like fight you over this wordsmithery. playoff adjacent. I love that. Anyway, here's the other thing. Like, beyond the off-ice stuff, the veteran stuff, the calming presence stuff. So Hughes Hronek, I don't think we're going to debate it at great length, has been Vancouver's top defensive pair this year. Okay? That shows up in the line numbers. That shows up.
We don't need to justify it. We all agree.
Obvious. Self-evident. Who would you pick second?
Well, they bounced around a lot, though. Right? Like, is there very little gap from 3 to 6 when these four guys are healthy?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of feels like four interchangeable guys.
But at least if you go by the underlying numbers, and then this is across, like, I'll use unblocked shot attempts because that's what I like most for evaluating defenders. I take misses out of the equation, right? I'm just looking at how you control shots that actually could score, right? 2 would be Cole Myers. 3 would be Cole Juleson. 4 would be Cole Friedman. Remember, they had that solid run early in the season helping Vancouver stabilize. And 5 would be Zadorov Cole. There's a common thread.
Mm-hmm.
There's a common thread across all of those pairs.
He's really good. He's smart.
Well, and he can play with, it seems like he can play with and elevate anybody. I mean, Juleson came into this season as sort of a seventh guy, like a fringy NHL player. I think he's leaving this season with us all feeling, and we all should feel pretty confident that he's like an everyday caliber NHL player with unique penalty killing value. And it's like, but, you know, he can play with Cole. And that pair can be effective.
Mm-hmm.
Throw him with Mark Friedman when this team really needed some stability on a pair that was often deployed in second pair minutes, and it worked. Like, it worked, and it worked really well. He played well with Myers when tasked with playing with Myers, and he bumped over to the right side right now on a third pair with Zadorov, and that pair's been nails. You know, and playing with Zadorov, I do think there's a little bit of Zadorov's at his best when he's trying stuff. But that's a double-edged sword sometimes, so you kind of have to have your pooper scooper ready.
Mm-hmm.
And Cole's comfortable doing that.
All right. Rick Tocchet apparently spoke for 21 minutes after practice at Rogers Arena today, which I think is a record for Rick Tocchet's media availabilities in his time here in Vancouver. So we won't play all of it. Obviously, we're close to the end of the show here, but we'll play a selection of what Rick Tocchet had to say about his team after a short optional practice at Rogers Arena today. Here is Rick Tocchet. That's here not Rick Tocchet.
Here is Windows 95.
We blue screen to death it there? No? All right. Well, we'll see. Now we'll play like 8 minutes of Rick Tocchet after we get back to it.
Here is Rick Tocchet, the Canucks bench boss / operating system.
Rick Tocchet's getting a firmware upgrade. All right.
Make sure your laptop's plugged in as we upgrade from Boudreaux to Tocchet.
And what an upgrade.
Oh, Boudreaux's not that bad.
No, but it's worked really well with
Rick
Tocchet.
Can't argue with the results, no question.
It has worked really, really well. All right. This text comes in, David in Surrey, and we have talked about this, but he says, can you talk about Rick Tocchet's chances of winning the Coach of the Year award? I would say very high.
Locked in.
Yeah, locked in. You got to think. At this point,
would be a jaw hits the floor stunner.
All right.
If he didn't.
And speaking of the presumptive Jack Adams front runner, now here's Rick Tocchet.
Well, you do a little bit of a game review, what we could do better, show some of the things that we did well. It's one of those things. You have an optional for guys. I think especially after the first game, a lot of emotions, a lot of guys building up, and I think it's important that if guys feel that they need to stay off the ice, that you take that. But there is information that we can get better at going into tomorrow, and so we had our meeting about that.
You said you felt like your team had another level that they can get to. What does that entail?
I think a little better on the forecheck, edge battles off draws, things like that. I think we can be better. I think as the playoffs go on, you always look for that level of play. You look at the game and could have gone either way. So how do we get better at it? But the one good thing that I always respect our team is our play without the puck. You know, we don't give up a lot. And when you don't give up a lot, it helps working on other parts of your game. You know, we don't always have to fall back on, you know, D-zone coverage and stuff like that. We can concentrate on other things, which helps our team.
Rick, how much was yesterday about just like a build waiting to break through and get those back-to-back goals? It felt like you guys were playing the type of game that you wanted in the first half, just nothing seemed to break. Or how did you guys think it built up throughout the game?
Well, obviously the tying goal, right? You know, getting that puck in the middle with our level of traffic, that was big. You know, that's a big goal, and I think it just everybody breathed after that. And obviously getting a goal off the forecheck, the Garland forecheck with Lindholm and Dakota like 12 seconds later. I mean, that's a huge momentum for us, especially after killing those penalties. And I felt, you know, I didn't feel any panic the whole game, but I felt after we scored those two goals, you could see guys were like breathing a little bit, seemed a little bit looser, I guess.
I guess with all the emotions yesterday, especially at the first period and the way that game starts and everything, now that you've had a night to sleep on it, does the team kind of take a step to the next level of like, hey, okay, we know what playoff hockey is like and we can see this in game two, or is it going to be high emotions just as it was in game one?
Yeah, I don't know. I know the players were pretty a lot of wow after the game of how loud the crowd was. I thought some guys told me they got emotional during it. So I think going into this next game, I'm sure the crowd is going to be just as loud where same passion, same thing, same emotion. Just, you know, make sure that – cut down on the penalties and, you know, some stuff system-wise we can be a little bit better. I think you just got to be in check a little bit emotionally, but I thought you got to feed off the fans. It's great.
Rick, how much more do you learn of the game watching the video than you see from the bench?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think as the game goes, like for me in real time, I kind of know, like I don't need the next day to kind of validate. You know, the odd time, you know, hey, I misread. But I kind of knew what I thought last night was, you know, what I watched today. It's a matter of good coaching is, and that's why I'm lucky I got a great staff, is how do you present it to the players without being negative or without, you know, being too positive. Like where it's, you know, hey, we won the game, you can't correct things. I think it's important, you know, you tell a story. And whatever our story today with the players is going to help us for tomorrow. So I think that's what I look at a video for, like creating your narrative to the players. What, you know, what can we do to get better? So that's what we spent all morning on.
People talk about adjustments, but I mean, at this point, I mean, is it just more tweaks rather than wholesale changes?
Yeah, I think the tweaks, for sure. I mean, let's face it, you know, they know us, we know them. There might be some stuff there that they're going to adjust on, and we got to be ready for it, you know, vice versa. So, but no, you got, there's, and a lot of times you in-game adjustments too, whether you put, take a guy off a line, you try different things. You can't be afraid to do that in game. And I think that's important that, you know, if that happens, don't be afraid to do it.
Hey, Rick, you've had Garland and Joshua together, obviously. They started with Suter, then it was Teddy, yeah. Now it's Elias. Why is it Elias now? Why did you see that as the fit when they had had such success with Bluger?
Yeah, it's a good question because I find with Teddy or with Dak and Gars, when they have a guy that's a smart guy but is around them a lot, they're successful. And if you watch Lindy, he's, you know, he's close to him. And if, like, you know, you heard Dak the other, last night say, you know, if he makes a mistake, he knows Lindy's got his back, right? It's kind of fun. It's kind of comforting to know when you have a guy, hey, if I do dive in or I make the wrong play, I got a Lindholm behind me. A la Teddy at the beginning of the year, Teddy was the same thing, very good, responsible guy. And Suter, another responsible guy. So I think those guys love the fact that they have that blanket, security blanket behind them, but also knowing that they can contribute offensively.
And last night you had Lindholm against O'Reilly as much as you had Miller, slightly more, but, you know, they both played a lot. But Lindholm said after, you know, they are the third line and, you know, they don't see the first pair that much for the other team. If you have a really good third line, how much of a wild card, how much of a difference maker can that be over a playoff series?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think to win, you have to have a third line. You know, and I guess every team's different. I'm not saying loading up doesn't work. I just feel for the way we're built. I like our, you know, whether you want to call it the third line or not. I mean, I think in the playoffs too, status and first, second, and third line. Everybody knows who the guns are, but you know that's a pretty damn good line. Whether you want to call them third or not, it's a good line.
Rick, you wind up winning without necessarily your top players figuring heavily yeah. in the scoring. Now with JT and Bess in that line, they controlled play quite a bit. Petey's line, not as much. They spent a bit of time on their own end, and we've been talking about Petey since the All-Star break.
Sure.
You're going to need him at some point. I know you know that, to produce. What can you do at this stage of the season when the games matter so much for him to find more?
Yeah. Well, we got to help him. It's my job. I got to get him in, you know, try to get him in a good frame of mind every night. You know, they struggled a little bit. I thought Hoggy was caught in between. I don't think Hoggy helped. I'm not blaming Hoggy, but I think they were the forecheck, they were just disconnected. When they're connected, they're a good line. And it feels like if they could just each guy do their job, if you know, whatever that job is, just stick with it. It might not happen the first two shifts. And I think sometimes they abort it too quickly because, you know, whether they're frustrated. And you know, I had a good talk with Pete after the game. You know, he's not frustrated. I think he's going to play. I think he knows what he has to do better. But the forecheck for me on that line was just okay. And when you're not forechecking, you're not coming up with loose pucks, what are you doing? You're chasing the game. So I think they just got to stick with the system, and when there's a chance to be creative. You know, we don't want to take the stick out of their hands. I just think that they got to get the puck first before they be creative.
And you talked about practice, that, you know, emotional game last night. Yeah. You wanted to give guys time off if they wanted it. Have you got a philosophy on when you want to practice during the playoffs? Does it matter on whether you win or lose, or how many days you have between games, or what matters to you?
That's a good question. My philosophy is practice. I would rather practice today early in the series. But because of, I think there's some guys that haven't played playoff game because of the emotional, you know, whatever the I could tell guys were spent after the game. But usually early in the season, I really believe teams should practice for 15, 20, 30 minutes and then take this. And I'm not a morning skate guy, but I felt the guys deserved it. And the beauty with this, guys, they always tell me, you decide. And I want them, no, you guys can decide, because it's, you know, I think at this stage of the playoffs, you got to give the player freedom. What's the best for you to perform tomorrow? You know, it doesn't always have to be my decision. So I just felt, just take an optional. It's up to you guys. And that's why I only think that 7 or 8 guys went on today, right? I think it was 7, 8 guys. 10? 9. There.
Rick, the penalty kill last night, you talked about it post-game, yeah, about how important it was. When you got here, it was almost historically bad, the numbers that have been putting up. What's been the biggest change? I know there's a lot of different personnel, and was that what all those guys last night, well, that's what they're all brought in here for specifically?
Yeah, I think personnel really helps. Obviously, getting Teddy Lindholm, obviously, later, Ian Cole. So I think those are the type of players that have helped. Dakota's increased play. And, you know, a little bit of system stuff has helped. Saying that, I think there's, if we had better clears this year, right, I think, honestly, we're up at 2 more percent. I think we're up in the 80, or like, I think the clears have cost us, so that, or our exits, that's our next level. How do we get better at that? But overall, the system part and the personnel have been really good, and you're going to have to kill a pressure situation. If they score, they're up 2 goals, right? We score those 3. So to me, the personnel has really helped. Give Patrick a lot of credit going those type of guys. That's helped us. And then also, like an Ian Cole. Like I've seen him in action in big games, killing a penalty.
That is a little bit of what Rick Tocchet had to say. He kept talking for a long time after that. But there is Rick Tocchet after the team had an optional short practice. Of course, they'll be back on the ice for game 2 tomorrow, and some commentary there on the Pettersson line.
The next reporter that plugs a Rick Tocchet 101, it's going to be like, whoa, we've heard enough.
No, there's never enough. We can never have enough Rick Tocchet content.
No, honestly, he's awesome to listen to. It's great. But also, 20 minutes? My goodness.
It's a lot of him at his playoffs.
Yeah.
That extra attention.
Unreal.
But, yeah, just to wrap up the thoughts, the thing that stood out to me there, the thoughts on the Pettersson line and just calling them a little bit disconnected, pointing to the forecheck as the key there. And, you know, he did single out, and again, he said he wasn't blaming Nils Höglander, but just, you know, a few moments that were a little bit off for Nils Höglander. I think a lot of people who watched the game would agree with that. But as we said earlier in the show, they need Höglander to be good. And if that line gets going, it's going to be a big, big deal for the team. No doubt about it. All right. That wraps up our first 3-hour playoff edition of Canucks Talk. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for texting in. We will be back tomorrow for game 2 to set up game 2 at Rogers Arena here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.